Hello!
Hello!
I'm Max Davey.
And I'm Tess Davey, and I have the hiccups.
Yes.
And this is the ADHD Science Podcast.
Hooray, yes, correct, it is. We've passed the first 30 seconds of this episode.
Yeah.
We are going to do one more episode and then go and have a summer break because somebody has A-levels.
Can't think who that might be.
Clue, it's not me.
The dog?
Look at him. He's not going to do A-levels.
Well, they can't see him. It's just audio.
He's too sleepy.
Anyway, yes.
We are going to do an interview today. Back to our interview format with Pete Etchells.
Pete Etchells.
So Pete is someone that I've known for a few years, and he has recently written a brilliant book called Unlocked, which basically debunks all the nonsense about screen time that is currently going on in the news. So this is a really important interview.
You're all about debunking. That's kind of your whole thing.
I'm a big debunker. So enjoy. Let's not have too much more chatter.
Because I need to go and revise.
Enjoy the interview.
Enjoy.
Right. A big ADHD Science welcome to Professor Pete Etchells.
Thank you for having me.
All right, no worries. Pete is Professor of Psychology and Science Communication at Bath Spa University. And the author of Unlocked. Tell me what the subtitle is. The Real Science of Screen Time? Is that
correct? You know, I always forget it. I can never remember. It's The Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better.
Exactly right. Okay. So a great book that I have reviewed and really enjoyed, and I thought I would get Pete on to talk about the relationship between screen time and attention. This, of course, being an ADHD podcast. So it's a bit of a sideways move for us because it's not directly about ADHD, but I think it's a topic that I get asked about a lot with my ADHD families and ADHD clinics. So.
And with this being such a sideways episode, we're asking different questions.
I know.
Which has really disturbed. Thrown me off. But I think I can cope with it.
Right. Shall we start?
Yes, yeah, let's go for it. Okay. Our first question is what seems like quite a simple question, but then you kind of get into it and you realise. So what is attention?
I don't know.
Right, good. Next.
Perfect. Okay.
Just a reminder, Pete is a professor.
It's a great question because I think and this is like a running theme in my book, right, which maybe feels like a bit of a cop-out at times, but attention is it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So it's this weird thing, right, where, you know, you talk about attention in day-to-day life and everybody knows what you're talking about. But, you know, if you just stopped at some point and said, can you define attention? I think we'd all really struggle with it. And we'd probably come up with lots of different definitions of what we actually mean by that. From a research point of view, a psychological point of view, it feels like there's a bit of an existential crisis in the literature at the minute because the same thing's happening. So lots of people, like there are literally thousands of studies published on attention. But they're all slightly different types. So you have some studies that maybe look at selective attention. And a classic example of this is what's called the cocktail party effect. So this idea that, you know, if you're in a party and you're chatting to somebody and there's lots of background noise going on, but somebody else nearby says your name, you kind of tune into that and pick it up. Right. So you've got this radar that's sort of going off all the time, attending to your surroundings. But, you know, there's other things like spatial attention, visuospatial attention, audio attention, divided attention, sustained attention, and things like that. But because all of these things, and they're very different things, are called attention in some way, shape or form, because we use that terminology, there's this underlying assumption that they're all part and parcel of a singular system. And that doesn't seem to be the case, and there's a sort of big, almost philosophical argument in the literature at the minute around whether attention as a thing actually exists in the brain or whether it's what we might call an emergent phenomenon. And a sort of a classic example of what you might think of as an epiphenomenon is, I can't remember which famous philosopher it was now, but talking about consciousness, that, you know, if you're an alien being and you land in the north of England in the 1800s and you wander over a hill and you see a factory, and above the factory you see a cloud of smog, right? You might assume that, you know, the smog cloud is, you know, it's above the factory, so it controls what's going on in the factory in some way, shape or form, because it's linked to it by this big stick chimney, and they seem to be, and it's moving about a lot and it's really active and the factory seems to be quite static. So you misunderstand the situation, right? It seems like this cloud of smoke is something meaningful, when actually it's a byproduct of what's going on in the factory. And there are some arguments in the literature that the attention is a little bit like that, right? There are lots of other processes going on, and the net effect of that is this thing that we experience as unified attention, but it doesn't actually really sit anywhere in particular in the brain. So that's that. Yeah. There's another line of thinking that kind of ties in with this, right, which is that rather than thinking of like an attention center or attention centers within the brain, that what we think of attention is almost like a heat map system. So you've got lots of different parts in your brain that represent the outside world. So the back of your brain is the visual cortex, right in the back. And actually what goes in the visual cortex is that, you know, right at the what we call the occipital pole, right at the back in the center, that corresponds to like your central field of vision. And as you radiate out, as you go to like the peripheral bits of the primary visual cortex, that represents sort of the bits of your vision in the periphery, in the wider space. So it literally does almost like provide a cortical map of what it is that you're looking at. And you see, so, you know, if you see something, you know, appear in one area, you know, if I'm looking at my screen and something appears over here, it will kind of get represented by electrical activity in the corresponding area of my visual cortex. So there's this emerging line of thinking that, you know, maybe attention works in this way, right? So if you imagine your desk around you at the minute, and there's lots of stuff on it. There's a computer screen. You know, I've got two computer screens. I've got a light. Mm-hmm. I've got my phone.
That Lego
like
thing
that.
I just knocked over.
Yeah. You've got a Lego thing. And every time something happens in one of those things or somebody comes into the room, you kind of see a spike in activity on that attention map, as it were.
Okay, yeah.
So your attention's kind of distributed across this area. But if there's like a big spike in something, then, you know, you'll move your focus to that thing. So there's some neuroscience research that kind of finds these sort of what we call priority maps or heat maps in the brain. And there's lots of different types of them at different layers, and they all kind of overlay each other. And I can't get my head around that concept quite easily because things become really complex really quickly.
Yeah.
So I talk about this in the book because there's this long-running idea that one way of characterizing attention is in a slightly different way, in what's called the spotlight metaphor of attention. Mm. This idea that you imagine that you're, I don't know, like you're out at sea on a boat and you've got a big searchlight, right? And you're searching for something like an island or another boat in the sea. And wherever you point in the spotlight, you can see what's going on in that really clearly, but everything else is completely pitch black and it might as well not be there. And the analogy is that our attention is like that. So whatever I might be kind of looking at or focusing on at that particular point in time has my attention, and I'm kind of ignoring other things. So when we talk about things like smartphone use, if, you know, WhatsApp pings on, you know, if I'm trying to write something or I'm, you know, talking to you guys on this, on my computer, but my phone, an alarm goes off, that will grab my attentional spotlight and I'll look at my phone, and then I'm stuck on that. Then I'm looking at that thing for a while, and it's very hard to get back to the thing that I was doing. And certainly that feels like the experience that we have a lot of the time, that phones really distract us or games distract us, and it's hard to kind of get back on task a lot of the time because we're distracted by social media or whatever. Whereas the idea with this sort of priority map way of thinking is that it's not just the bottom up, you know, visceral, does it make a pingy noise to attract your attention that grabs your attention. There's other things that factor into that, things like, what are your goals? What's your motivation at the time?
I see, yeah.
So, you know, have these kind of top-down processes that impact on it. So it's a very long-labored example of this in the book where I try and, you know, really work this through and go, you know, if I've got my computer up and I'm trying to write a book in this case or whatever it is that I'm doing and my phone pings off, in some scenarios, I'll look at my phone because, in a way, I kind of want to be distracted because I'm finding this piece of writing really hard and I want a bit of a distraction for a bit, something like
that. Or you want a break or something.
Or you want a break, yeah. Or actually, you know, you've been waiting for a really important message from friend or family member or something like that. So you know, it has inherent value. Whereas in other situations, you know, actually I've got a deadline coming up and I really need to focus on this. I know the other day I got distracted quite a lot. So it's really important to me that I finish this task that I'm doing. Your phone pings off. On your attention priority map, it's much less of a spike because you've got these top-down goals keeping you on focus. And maybe in that scenario, you don't look at it.
And presumably that's also accounts for the fact that if you haven't slept or if you are emotionally in particular indifference or you're unwell, that will affect your the nature of your priority map and how sensitive it is to different stimuli in your environment.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, it affects your very short-term goals, you know, especially if you're feeling in survival mode, if you've not got much sleep. Right. So that will have an impact and that will make you a lot more distractible in that sort of scenario. It kind of makes it harder to focus on work, right? So you'll do more downtimey things in that situation as well anyway. But yeah, there's not that much research that focuses on this. And in some ways it's a controversial thing to say. Just because, you know, and I'm not saying that the spotlight attention metaphor is wrong. You know, again, even just on that topic, there are literally thousands of studies and decades of work. I think it's a really useful way of thinking about attention. But my worry is sometimes it gets misapplied when we talk about attention in the context of digital technology use and smartphone use and things like that.
Go on.
I do really wonder how that, what was it you called it, the priority map, how that would look for somebody who did have ADHD, but more specifically when they're like in a hyperfocus.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Because then I feel like at that point, there's not even like, it's a lot harder to be brought out of there. So I wonder if that would...
Yeah, I think that captures in a way what you were saying, Pete, is that there's lots of different sorts of attention. So one of the things that people with ADHD and also other neurodevelopmental conditions find hard is switching between tasks. Sometimes there's too much switching, and sometimes when you're really absorbed with something, there's not enough switching, and it's led to people rejecting the idea of ADHD as an attention deficit and thinking about it more as an attention control issue.
Right.
So it's not about you haven't got enough attention.
Yeah.
It's just that your attention is not as effectively under your conscious control, I suppose, would be.
But then again, we get back to the thing that we don't even really know what attention is. So how can you have a deficit of it if you don't?
Well, exactly. But it almost makes the attention deficit idea more meaningless because if you don't even know what the thing is. I mean, just to come back to that point that you made, that there are lots of different sorts of attention, my understanding from the book is that it's not even that if you're good, whatever in inverted commas, at one kind of attention, you're good at another kind of attention. It's not even so, you know, it could be that there's not a single area of the brain, but a person who is good at, you know, so a person who's good at running a certain distance will tend to be good at running another distance, you know, and other physical tasks. But there's not even that correlation. They're quite distinct in terms of performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of interesting you were saying about that idea of task switching, because I think one thing, certainly when it comes to trying to understand some aspects of social media effects and digital tech effects, one thing that you come across a lot is this idea of task switching. So there's a common refrain certainly in the pop science around this, that what's going on when you've got a phone basically is that you're switching between doing different things a lot, right? So it might be on your phone, you're switching between different forms of social media and a game or something like that. And then that's exacerbated by, you know, you're trying to do, I don't know, an essay or read a book or something like that. And the idea is that when you move your attention from one thing to another, there's a cost that comes with that, like a cognitive cost. It's called the switch cost effect. And there's a bunch of studies that show that, you know, you see like, sort of the way that this has been framed in the research area is in terms of like almost like brain power loss. That when you kind of switch between, if you're a heavy multitasker, if you kind of use lots of different media all the time and you're looking at loads of different screens, that sort of switching between things takes slightly longer than for people who are light media multitaskers.
Okay.
And we're only talking about like between 1 and 200 milliseconds. Things take a bit longer, but you know, over switching between things quite a lot, that could potentially mount up. So the idea with this sort of, there was a very famous study that was published in 2009 that showed this, that you know, if you look at people who sort of describe themselves as, you know, they're looking at lots of things at the same time when they're trying to do something, you get this very precise switch cost. And it reinforced this worry that we have about screens, that if you're flicking your quote unquote attention, if you're flicking your attention between lots of different media in parallel, so the translation is usually, you know, like if you sat in your lounge and you're watching a TV program, but also you're flicking through social media on your phone, or maybe, you know, you've got your Switch up as well, you're trying to play a game, that makes you distractible. It makes you more distractible and you make more mistakes when you're trying to do something important, like write an essay or something like that. And it was quite a captivating finding in the literature. But it's also one that we've not really moved on. We've not learned more about since. So that paper came out in about 2009, I think. And then a few years ago in 2021, a bunch of researchers looked at that specific study, that paper, and you know, basically were like, well, what's happened in the 10 or so years since this paper came out? And basically, the answer was not much. So you get a lot of studies that show this sort of similar effect, but you know, this general idea that heavier media multitaskers have more problems with distractibility. But when you look at the size of the effect, it doesn't seem to be practically significant. So it's statistically significant, but you know, whether it actually means anything in the real world, it doesn't seem to be the case.
Was that a paper? I don't remember the paper. I think I've read the original paper. Was that just reporting how people reported that they used media? They weren't kind of subjecting people to an experimental condition.
This was an experimental study, and okay. there were a bunch of experiments within the study itself. One of the weird things about it was the way that a light or heavy media multitasker is defined is not very simple. And it took me quite a long time to get my head around it. There's quite a complicated equation in the supplementary material that they use to sort of create this weird measure that it turns out it includes, you know, so when you're defining what sorts of media people are talking about, it includes reading books as well. And it was university undergraduate students that were measured, that were tested, right? So that sort of definition, they're all going to be some sort of media multitasker because they're all reading stuff in at least a couple of different formats, right? So, and this is the thing that you see quite a lot in this literature. If you just do like a surface level reading of the paper and they talk about heavy versus light multitasking, your initial, and it, you know, I did this too. Like I had to read the paper like 5, 6, 7 times to really get my head around what it was that they were measuring. But at face value, you look at that and you go, okay, right, so it's heavy multitaskers are people who use like five or more different media at the same time, and light multitaskers are 3 or less, you know, for the sake of argument. And that makes sense, makes simplistic sense, but actually that's not what they did.
That's not what they're measuring.
It's way more complicated than that. But then that's what it gets translated to when you take that paper and try and explain it in a more general pop science sense. You focus on light versus heavy multitasking, which then people interpret as, oh, if you have lots of screens on in front of you and you're trying to do too many things at once, then that's bad. And this is something that I've struggled with a lot with this book in pretty much every single topic that I cover. Is, you know, I was trying to approach this as, you know, I don't have a vested interest either way into what's going on. What I want, the part of the reason that I wanted to write this book was to go, everybody's freaking out about this stuff. Is that justified? And if so, okay, then we know more about the science. If not, why not? And most of the time, it feels like the answer is that we're focusing and freaking out about the wrong things in many ways. And what happened was that, you know, you find a paper that people talk about in the mass media or in pop science books. They talk about this paper a lot, and they say, you know, this study shows this clear effect, and this is what they did. And then you look at the paper, and you can see where that line comes from, because it's basically in the abstract, right? It's in the abstract, and it's in the discussion. And then you read the paper, and you look at the study that they did and the data that they collected, and it doesn't match. It doesn't add up.
Is there an element of this?
Sorry, go on.
So is there an element of scientists wanting the kind of incentive for scientists to slightly sex up their results and make them kind of a bit more eye-catching?
Yeah, there is an element of that. Definitely. And it really feels in some cases there is an element of you go into this study with a clear idea of what you're going to find.
Mm.
And the data don't quite match that. And literally, like in some cases, there were some studies that I had to get other colleagues to look at because I was like, have I just lost the plot here? Because they say in this study that blue light from screens has a really strong impact on sleep in this group of participants. But like I'm looking at the data, I'm looking at the graphs that they've drawn in the results, and they're not showing any effects. But then they've said in the discussion there's a really clear effect here, and I'm like, well, it's bizarre. And part of it, I think, is there's this weird paradox with digital tech in the, and I've said this before about video games is the classic example here. That, you know, I've said in the past to people, I do research on video games, and they kind of laugh at me a little bit. Not in a mean-spirited way, but just like, all right, okay, so you've got an Xbox in your lab. How is that? Is that fun? And I go, yes, I do have an Xbox in my lab, and it is fun. Thank you very much. But there's this sort of sense that it's kind of not a real science. It's like a soft science, and you're doing something that's not, you know, you're doing it because you wanted an Xbox in the lab. And at the same time, everybody's panicking about the detrimental effects of video games, right? You know, everybody's genuinely worried, understandably in some ways, you know, that kids playing violent video games 20 years ago, is it going to make them more aggressive?
Yeah.
6 years ago, it was, if you play Fortnite, is it addictive? You know, these are really kind of high-level societal worries that we have, genuine worries that they have. But then we don't see the science as a proper science in a way.
Yeah.
And I think there's an element of that in all digital tech research, that it's not seen as proper science sometimes, but at the same time, we're really worried about it and really want answers.
Hmm.
Well, I think a lot of this is around, do
we want answers, or do we want to be told to have our prejudices confirmed? I suppose that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. This is sort of one of the things that I really try to focus on in the book is why have we got into this state?
Yeah.
That, you know, why do we worry about these things to the level that we do?
I think we're going to come back to that.
Science helping?
Yeah, we're going to come back to that. But yeah. I think we sort of need to move on from the first question that we've got. And I suppose what I get from what you've been saying is that, first of all, it's very difficult to say that there is a single thing called attention, that there are several models for attention, that it sounds like there's a bit of a preference for the kind of priority map, which would be quite, you know, actually fits in quite nicely with some of the ways that we talk about ADHD as well, which would be quite useful for our listeners. And also that a lot of the research does not quite say what it purports to say. I think it's probably fair. I think it's important to take away when we talk about attention kind of practically. I've been thinking about this, and I think when we talk about attention clinically, we're talking about the sorts of tasks that we think involve a lot of attentional resources. Are you good at those or not? And what we're not really directly measuring attention. We're just sort of triangulating from a few different tasks that we think are probably going to require a lot of attentional resources. And if you have problems with all of those tasks, you've probably got a problem with the control of your attentional resources and the distribution of them. But it's really funny. You're very honest and forthcoming about the shortcomings of your kind of field. But clinically, we are just so Stone Age compared to that. We're just like, are you bad at these things? Oh, you've probably got an attention problem. Yeah. It's quite basic, really.
Yeah, yeah, that's a big issue, right? Because you've been talking about this idea of attention as a limited resource in the brain somehow, that you've got like a pool of attention and that you've only got maybe so much per day or so much per task or the ability to do certain things, and that could be right. It could be the case that attention is this sort of limited resource, and then it kind of acts as a cognitive bottleneck. There's only so much information that you can process at a given time. But it could be the complete opposite of that, right? So it could be the case that we've got all of this sensory information bombarding us constantly, right? And there's too much coming in to process all at the same time. And you don't need to, because most of it's useless. Like, I don't need to know that there's a light here all the time, because it's just a light. I can just leave it there, right? So we have so much sensory information coming in that attention is actually a way of dealing with that bottleneck. So attention is a way of like filtering things and allowing us to focus on relevant details. And they're subtly different, but they're kind of important ideas. And there's evidence, really good lines of thinking that track both. Right. But the problem's bigger than that, even, because I think what we talk about, certainly in terms of like digital tech use, when we talk about attention, it's something else entirely. Right. So, we talk about attention spans. And I think a lot of time when people talk about attention and, this idea that our attention spans have collapsed because of our phones, that actually what they're talking about maybe is media multitasking or maybe distractibility or kind of the self-control and the ability to manage those things.
Well, I think
it's just a mess of definitions, right?
Yeah, it is. Well, I think so. Should we move on to another mess of definitions? Second question.
Okay. Well, this one, my first instinct is that it won't be as messy. But wow. I mean, feel free to be wrong. What is? Oh, go on.
Go on.
Okay. What is screen time?
Screen time is a very easy, simple to define concept, right? Which is the amount of time that you spend on some sort of screen-based activity. And you could define it as, how many minutes in the last day, how many hours in the last week or month. And that is screen time. And it is a very compelling measure for scientists to measure. It is also completely meaningless.
Yeah, see, this is the part.
Okay, go ahead.
Explain why it's completely meaningless, because this is the sting.
So we've been talking for about 45 minutes now, right? So that's 45 minutes of screen time. Somebody else somewhere in the world might have been watching Netflix for the last 45 minutes. Somebody else might have been watching, a 6-year-old might have been watching like an 18 rated movie that they shouldn't have been for 45 minutes. There might be somewhere in the world, somebody who spent 45 minutes on the computer learning about something new for their homework, and somewhere else, somebody spent 45 minutes on Instagram really worrying about their body image and things like that.
Yeah.
And I'd say even in the past month, this conversation's moved on a bit, but not much. And like, 5 years ago, you look at the research in this area and all of those people would be categorized as having 1 hour of screen time. Mm-hmm. And actually, I see papers published nearly on a weekly basis where people are taking those broad strokes measures of screen time. And what they're trying to do is look at, is there a relationship between this gross amount of screen time that people have or people use and some sort of outcome, whether it's educational attainment or depression or something, whatever the interesting thing of the day is.
Yeah.
And 1 hour of screen time in that sort of definition doesn't tell you anything useful, because in all of those situations that I just described, there will be very different outcomes, right? Some of them are very clearly negative and will potentially harmful to the person involved. Some of them are positive and will have a net benefit. But actually the reality of it is that our screen time, even in those sorts of examples, isn't that simple to define, right? So, I said, we've been talking for 45 minutes now. My screen time is this conversation.
Yeah.
Mm.
I also have a secondary computer screen up here with my book open and some notes and stuff just in case they're useful. I've got my phone, so I might get pinged messages and things like that. So what's the differential effect of all of those things? Because this is not actually 45 minutes of a video call for me. It's 45 minutes of a video call plus X number of minutes of reading, technically. And I try and lay this out in the book in a lot more detail, in that, there's this hour of screen time that I have where, if you ask me in a week's time, that hour of screen time was me writing my book. But actually, at the time, I tried to, on a minute-by-minute basis, say what I was doing. And it was probably only 25 minutes of writing my book. And there was certainly 20 minutes of scrolling through Twitter.
Yeah.
Or X, if we have to call it.
No one calls it X. Actually, no one.
It's terrible. Terrible name. But even in that 20 minutes of scrolling through Twitter, some of it was, 2.5 minutes of watching a really funny cover song video. A few minutes was clicking through to a news article that upset me about something. A few minutes of it was in private messages with some colleagues, just bouncing ideas for a project. In a week's time, when you get me to do a screen time study, I say I had 1 hour of, book writing time on that Tuesday, which is completely unrepresentative of what I did. But when you start to look at it at the level of actually what was going on, you realize quite quickly that it becomes a very difficult, if not impossible, task to say, okay, you've really accurately described all of those things that you did on a screen over the past hour. How do we work out what the net benefit or net negative is to your mental well-being, say, if that's what you're interested in?
I mean, I imagine that even if you did try and break it down into like, this time was spent on social media, this time was spent on Google Docs, Google Slides, you still wouldn't be able to find like that this is good and this is bad, because you could have been on like YouTube watching videos like about how to do this piece of homework that you're working on.
Yeah, yeah.
So even when you look at it on that level, you still can't make those. It's just not that simple, essentially.
No, I think there's a sort of big thrust of the book, isn't it? Really, that actually what you're doing is the crucial thing when you're thinking about the impact of screen time.
Yeah, so obviously there's a big debate going on at the minute around this idea of whether social media is driving declines in mental illness, particularly in teenagers. And you look at the trajectory of that debate, and that very much started out as screens are are driving this. Mm. And that's literally the case. Like, it starts in 2017 with a very famous article published in The Atlantic. And in that article, the author writes, you know, based on the research that they've done, it seems to be the case that all screen activities are linked to less to lower happiness, and all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. And we're literally talking about it at the level of the screen there. And that gets picked up and it gets criticized. And then the goalposts shift a little bit. And suddenly we start talking about social media. And then very quickly the goalposts shift again and we start talking about social media use in teenage girls. And what we kind of see over the course of that, and that's where we're up to now, that people like Jonathan Haidt and Gene Twenge sort of criticize the critics by saying, well, you know, it's a bit of a straw man to talk about screen time not being a meaningful concept anymore, because of course it's not, because actually if you look at the data, the problems are here in this particular population in this situation, right? I find that very frustrating, because it's almost like we've forgotten that the replication crisis happened in psychology. Because what's happening there is that, you know, you're saying one thing based on the data, and then that's getting criticized, and then you're moving what it is that you're talking about. And it's almost like this weird form of p-hacking, right? You keep changing the thing that your definition of what it is that you're looking at, until you get to a point where there's a link between two things that you're arguing is so incontrovertible, you can't disagree with it anymore. And it's a very emotionally reactive debate, and everybody's got very strong opinions about this at the minute, but I think we're going in the wrong direction, because again, if we go back to what we were talking about before in terms of thinking about what screen time actually is and how complicated it is and how nuanced even that hour that we talked about, one of the things that I say in the book that you realize very quickly that actually asking questions like what's the effect of social media on mental health, what's the effect of screen time on mental health, it's just the wrong question to ask, right? You just can't get the data that you need to answer that. And there are more appropriate questions to ask that get to what people are actually worried about, which is what things are worrisome and why.
Yeah. So I think that's the question. That's the question we want to get onto.
Yes.
But I want to go back just to quickly, because you mentioned two things that need definition. One is the replication crisis and the other is p-hacking.
Yes. Okie dokie. Yeah, that's good. Good point.
I'm really lacking today.
That's all right. It's late.
So the replication crisis basically it sort of happens around about 2011 in psychology. And one of the big things that happens then is that a paper's published that seems at face value shows the existence of psychic ability. So I'll try and explain it as quickly as possible. There were lots of different experiments in this study, but just to give you like a simple example, a very basic experiment that you can do in memory research is you give people 10 words to remember. You give them a bit of time to do that. And then you have a break for like, say, 20 minutes. And then you give them 20 words, and 10 of them they saw before and 10 they didn't. And you ask them, you know, this word, did you see it before? Yes or no? Right. So that's the most kind of boring, bog standard memory experiment you can do. You know, you put more manipulations in there, right? To, you know, maybe you do something like have one condition where you really stress people out in that 20 minute break and another one where you don't, to see what the impact of stress is on people's ability to recall words that they saw before. And not kind of inadvertently recall, you know, sometimes you'll say what is a new word, you'll say, actually, I saw that before, what we call a false positive, right? In this paper, they flipped that around. So what happens first is you get a list of 20 words and you say, do you think you're going to be shown this later on? Yes or no? And then there's a break, and then the computer randomly selects 10 words to show the participant at the end of it, right? And what they found in that study was that people were more likely to recall or recall, quote unquote, say that they were going to be shown words that they were later shown. It's okay. Like evidence of precognition, right?
Yeah.
So
the psychic abilities exist then?
Yeah, that was the take home. So what set this paper apart from most other research on, you know, parapsychology? It's generally, you know, there's a lot of research in that area. It's generally pretty poor.
Mm.
But this was, it was published in a very esteemed journal, a very prestigious journal. It was published by researchers who had a really good pedigree in doing research. It used these techniques that we knew were, you know, standardized techniques in memory research. So what happened was that we were left with this, sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. So either this study is right and literally everything that we know about everything goes out the window because psychic abilities change everything, right? Or there is something so fundamentally broken with the way that we conduct science, publish it, get it out there, that something like this can happen, right?
Yeah.
What happens in the aftermath is that some other scientists come along and try to replicate the study, which is to say that they try and recreate the conditions of the original experiment to see if they get the same result. And they do that and they don't get the same result.
Mm.
So they find that actually people aren't any better at recalling words that they're going to be shown in 10 minutes into the future. No evidence of precognition. One of the things that kickstarted what we call the replication crisis is that those studies, it was very difficult for them to get published. So they went to the original journal that published the psychic abilities of real paper, and that journal said, we're not interested in this study. It doesn't tell us anything new. You found a what we call a null result or a negative result. It's not interesting. Now, that's a problem, right? Because if we're only publishing things that show a statistically significant, what we call a quote-unquote positive finding, and we're rejecting negative findings, then the published scientific literature is not representative of the reality of the science that we're doing, right? And what's happened in the past 10 years is that there's been a ton of research in psychology that shows that these sorts of things are happening. So, you know, there's a huge... I think it was like 100 different labs in 2015, basically took all of the papers from three big psychology journals that were published in one particular year, and across the world, across all of these labs, tried to replicate them all.
Mm.
And like 60% of them didn't. Like huge amount of them, just these things that we think are like really solid findings in psychology, it turns out when you start doing them properly, and openly and transparently, they don't replicate. So it led to this real crisis in psychology. You know, there was real anger and aggression from some quarters, because you had a bunch of, you know, a new generation of scientists coming along with really strong, really robust methods, saying these things, the ways that we've been doing psychology up to now are not right.
Mm.
They lend itself to the ability for people to do, you know, what we call questionable research practices, which are things like, you know, maybe you run a study and you analyze the data and it doesn't find the thing that you were expecting. So you go, or maybe I've done the analysis wrong. So I run the analysis in a different way, and you still don't find the thing that you're expecting. But you're like, yeah, I really thought that this is the finding we get. Mm. You keep running different sorts of tweaks to the analysis. Eventually, you find a positive, significant result. You go, that was the right way to do the analysis. And look, this thing exists. And then in the paper that gets published, you just report that one analysis that worked.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we call p-hacking,
yeah.
Right? That the more times you do an analysis like that, the more likely you are to get what we call a false positive. So a significant finding when actually none exists in reality. But you wouldn't know that from reading the paper, because there's nothing in that paper to suggest that you ran 20 or 100 or 5,000 analyses before you got the one that you wanted. Right?
So the implication of that for the debate around screen time is that old pre-replication crisis papers cannot necessarily be leaned on for evidence of harm.
Yeah, I think we have to take it, it's a tough one, right? Because what we're effectively saying there is that we have a much higher benchmark for good quality research now than we did even 10 years ago, but certainly longer ago. But in some ways, it's unfair to hold older research to those same standards because the tools and the processes that we have nowadays, they just simply weren't there and people weren't thinking about these things. Mm. And, you know, we're not saying that people were going around doing this deliberately or in a fraudulent way, although there were some notable exceptions that were.
Yes.
But yeah, this was just how things were done, and we just have to take those sorts of studies with a pinch of salt. But it feels like there's something similar going on, not in the research, but in the kind of public debates about this.
Mm.
In that, you know, people are convinced that there's something bad going on, right? So what inevitably happens in a lot of the conversations is that somebody goes, well, what about this research showing the effects of X on Y? Mm. And you go, well, here's some evidence to suggest that that's not right. And then they go, okay, yeah, but what about the effects of Z on Y? And then you show something, and it kind of becomes this list of, you know, eventually we'll find something where there's a significant relationship because we keep looking for it, and hard to push back against that. And what's not happening is nobody's stopping and going, hang on, why in the first place, why would we expect these things to be related? Why would we expect social media to have an impact either generally or specifically for girls or whatever? Mm. And, you know, how are we going to define, you know, social media are we put in the same category as screen time in the, you know, what social media is, you know, it's WhatsApp, which is text-based, local networks, it's Twitter, which is text-based, local and global networks. So by local, I mean friends and family. Global,
yeah,
sure. I mean,
yeah.
Twitter, you can talk
not
to
like the guy down the road.
Celebrities or whatever.
Instagram, not a WhatsApp group for our road, which is basically mainly about when the bins are out.
Yeah, and asking our dog to show.
Yeah, but this is the thing, right? Instagram visual, Clubhouse is audio. These are all social media. Texting, is that social media?
Yeah.
Well, in some definitions you could argue yes. Fortnite is basically a glorified social media network for a lot of kids, because they go on there after school and they use it to reconnect with their mates, right? And also they're playing a game at the same time by happenstance. Yeah. But,
well, you can't just do one thing.
So social media is poorly defined, and that's what allows this sort of flexibility in saying, well, we're worried about this thing and its effect on that. The same is also true for mental health.
Right? Yeah.
We talk about mental health as though it's this singular.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thing. Well, people try and make it a singular thing, but I think that's right. The effort to do it. You're going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to, this is just a brief point, but specifically within like social medias, then you get like so much variation, especially like after the TikTokification of like every social media. So, you know, Snapchat used to just be messaging.
Yeah.
And now they've got their own like short form video.
Oh, okay.
So Snapchat Spotlight. Instagram's got Instagram Reels. Facebook has Instagram Reels. You know,
yes,
YouTube
it does.
Shorts.
I don't hold with it personally. Well,
but yeah, that's just one little thing I wanted to add. You were saying about the mental health thing?
Oh, so there is an effort to make mental health a single phenomenon, and it flattens everything out to something that's almost, in the same way that screen time and social media as a single phenomenon, it flattens it out to something that's almost meaningless. I want to go on to the third, I'm not to be rigid in my structure, but the third question I think we should go into it, and then you've slightly touched on it, but I think digging into, well, ask the question and I'll kind of clarify.
Okay. Why do people think that exposure to screen time has a negative effect on attention?
And I think I'm thinking about that in terms of why is it that we have this deep-seated need for this to be true?
Mm.
Not necessarily how particular. Well, anyway, that's the question.
Mm. So I think the answer to this is that because we have all, to some extent, and for most of us, this is a little bit. For some people, it's a lot, which is a problem. We've all developed bad habits on our smartphones and screens and things like that. You know, everybody that I talk to has had lived experience of having a not good time on their phone at some point. And, you know, and by that, I mean things like, you know, we've all had that experience of, you know, feeling like we've overdone it. You know, I've had it a fair few times recently where I've been on Instagram kind of scrolling through videos because it's one of the ways that I unwind at night is finding funny cat and dog videos and toddler videos on, you know, relating to like parenting fails and things like that on Instagram. And do you know what? In the past year, the time, all of the times where I have like been in absolute fits of laughter, you know, tears streaming down my face, can't breathe because I've been laughing so much, has been from finding a funny video on Instagram. But at the same time, there are some nights where, because of the way the algorithm's working, I've been really tired and I've needed to go to bed, and an hour later I'm still there scrolling through and I've not really had a good time.
No, I mean, you're waiting for that one video that's going to make you laugh the hard you cry.
Yeah.
But you know, you don't get it. You just keep going. You're like, well, I don't want to turn it off now. Maybe it's the next video down, you know?
Yeah. And I think everybody can relate to that, right? We've all had some experiences along those lines. So when somebody comes along and says, these things have been designed to do that, to addict you to your phone, and that this is sort of something that's happening to you, and actually it's really bad, you know, this is causing real problems with mental health, it's a lot easier to relate to that than to a sort of slightly more complex reality, which is that phones aren't addictive by design. Phone addiction is not a thing. You know, it's not a clinical disorder. You're not addicted to your phone. You might have developed some bad habits and some good ones as well. And it's a lot harder to accept that and therefore do something about it, because changing habits is really hard, and it requires effort and intention. And it's not just something that you do once and it's fixed. You know, it requires quite a lot of long-term. It's kind of like ship. If you take like a massive ship, you can't just turn it around on a coin, right? It takes a long time for that thing to turn around if it's going in the wrong direction.
I think
there's an element of that to why we feel like, and also coupled with the fact that, you know, we're told constantly that they're bad for us, right? It's literally every week, nearly every day at the minute, there are stories in the news saying screen's bad for us, smartphones bad for us.
Tess,
in this context, I just want to make sure the differentiation is clear. How are we making blah, 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 how are we defining the difference between like a bad habit and like an addiction? Where's the line for that?
And what does bad mean?
Yeah, well, damaging.
Yeah, it's a good question, right? So habits are very much context dependent. So habits in and of themselves are neutral, right? So the example that I use in the book is literally just checking your phone. That is a neutral habit. It's not good for you. It's not bad for you. Whether it becomes good or bad depends on other things. So it depends on not just simply the frequency of how you do it. And we often talk about excessive use in this sort of way. And I'll come back to that to answer the other bit of your question in a minute. But, you know, if you engage in a phone checking behavior lots of times during the day, and you do that in a sort of mindless way, in a non-reflective way, eventually you will do it in a bad situation, right? So the really kind of facile example I give is checking your phone at night when you're feeling a bit lonely and you want to connect with friends. Good habit to get into, right? That's a nice thing to do, and it's probably going to be a good thing for your well-being. Checking your phone when you're driving down the road. No. Just to see what somebody's posted on Instagram. Super bad habit to get into, right?
Super bad.
Because, and the thing is, it's not necessarily going to be bad every time. So it's not the case that every time you check your phone while you're driving, you crash your car and somebody gets injured or killed. Actually, most of the time, that's not the case. But it increases the risk of it.
Yeah. I mean, quite a lot.
So... I mean, that's a bit of a kind of facetious example in a way, but basically habits become, you know, that tilt between whether it becomes a good or a bad habit for you depends on things like what you're doing, why you're doing it, what your particular aims and goals are, your intended use of your phone or whatever digital technology you're talking about, coupled with things like do you have pre-existing vulnerabilities that might exacerbate this? Do you have support networks around you that you can turn to when it does go wrong? And all of those things together will dictate in some way whether that bad habit translates into a bad outcome for you.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm really gathering from all this is that we just really can't answer any questions simply, can we? We can't just be like, why is my attention span bad? Social media. What is attention? It's just when you focus on stuff, you know, like, I mean, obviously we all wish it could be like that, but.
Well, do we? Do we want these simple answers?
I mean, how good would it be if you could just go, is there an afterlife? And I could just go, yeah. You know what I mean? Like these big questions, terrifying. These confusing questions. Well, you know, it would be nice to know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think there's something, I mean, I suppose that's part of the drive towards the simplistic narrative of phone's bad, social media bad.
Because then you've got an answer.
Yeah, it's an answer. It's an authority from on high telling you that this thing you're doing is bad.
And people need this, right? I mean, and you know this, Max, because that you came across this a few years ago when you were involved in writing screen time guidance, right? That what people wanted out of that was somebody to come along and say, 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
When you get to 2 hours and 1 minute, bad things happen.
Yes.
And the reason that parents want that is because it's really hard being a parent, right? And you're knackered all the time. And everybody's telling you about expectations about what to do with your kids in all sorts of different domains, right? And with the best intentions in the world, it's really hard to be the best in all of those. So it's great if somebody can come along so you can just have as like a script in your head, you know, the research, the science, you know, all the experts say, you know, 2 hours, and everybody kind of agrees on that, and it becomes a social norm. It's easier to manage. And I think that's why we crave these things sometimes. And I kind of get the sense that that's why so many people were angry with those guidelines when they came out, because they were really sensible, evidence-based guidelines that acknowledge this nuance, right? That sheer limits don't work. They don't work in a blanket sense, for sure. Mm. And what actually does work is having open and transparent conversations in your families about, you know, good, responsible screen use, you know, creating well-defined boundaries around that, having times in the day where you connect with each other, maybe not over screens, so you can just check in, see how people's days have been going.
Just waiting people to come for dinner, that sort of thing.
Don't look at me when you say that. I'm always there.
You are pretty good. It's your brothers. Your brothers are bad. Yeah.
Do you remember when you tried to set like a 2 hour screen time limit during like, was it 2021?
No, because I had, no, I did not do that, because I would not have done that, because okay. In 2019, I was the author of the screen time guidance for the Royal College, which explicitly did not say 2 hours.
Well, not, it wasn't screen time in general, at least. It was, you know, it was like 1 hour of video game time.
Well, yeah, there was, so, okay.
But to be honest, we did need it at that point. Yeah, but that's slightly, the thing, you know, slightly exposing me as a massive things.
Hypocrite. So just to explain that.
Everyone's a
hypocrite. Just to explain
that. Everyone is a hypocrite, apart from me.
Okay, let's just walk through this, because this is actually possibly not uninteresting. So
possibly
not. That should be on the tagline of the podcast. Possibly not uninteresting.
I'll make this a jingle.
In 2019, just to kind of just for the benefit of the listeners, so I wasn't the author, but I was kind of led the production of the Royal College of Paediatrics screen time guidance. And as Pete alluded to, we rejected the approach which was X amount of screens is fine. X plus 1 minute is not fine, because it doesn't make sense.
The goblins come out.
Having said which, I have had to struggle with now three teenage kids, and the fact that there have been times when the use of screens have disrupted family life. And I'm not saying, so I think it's really important to say, because I didn't have that 2 hours plus one approach, it doesn't mean that and I don't think either of us is saying this, Pete. Neither of us are saying that screens cannot be disruptive and cannot be harmful.
Yeah.
And that limits are not useful to put in place in particular settings. And you're right. We didn't just say 2 hours of screen time, because that we quickly concluded that was completely meaningless.
But we did put a limit on video games and, you know, PlayStation, and we tried to limit your YouTube use. Yeah. And I've tried, you know.
But then I would just go on YouTube and pretend I was doing work, which was a whole other thing.
Yeah, well, that happened.
So this is, I think, the crux of and it's really important. And I get a bit of pushback sometimes because, you know, in all the stuff that we talked about up till now, some people come along and say, okay, well, so what you're saying then is that there's nothing to worry about, and that's a ludicrous position to take. And you're right. I don't think anybody is saying that in this debate at all. What we're trying to figure out is how do we kind of more precisely define and interrogate the things that we should be worried about so that we can get workable solutions. And also, you know, how do we navigate these scenarios where you know, it very much is the case that people have arguments every night around screens and video games and things in the household, and they want help with that. Right? And I think what we've been trying to say is that it feels like the help that we want is for somebody to come along and say, look, no more than 2 hours a night. And the thing is that that's not going to fix anything. Like, if you come along and say, okay, well, the experts say that no more than 2 hours a night, so we're going to have to stick with the experts, that is not going to change what's happening at the minute. But the way that we approach these sorts of conversations, I think, is really important as well. So one of the bits of research that I allude to in the book that kind of taps into some of the things that you were talking about then is this idea of how we navigate these conversations as parents and caregivers and children around screen use. And there was a great paper a few years ago where they presented about 1,000 UK teenagers with these different vignettes, which is like a scenario where a parent caregiver is trying to maybe kind of create a screen time rule with a teenager. And there's a few different ways in which they do it. So this is like authoritarian approach. So it might be something like, you're not having a games console in your room because I'm the parent and I say so, and that's it. End of conversation, no more. Right. And then there's a bit more of maybe like a guilt tripping scenario where you go, why do you want a games console in my room? You know, why do you not want to talk to us? You know, that's really hurting my feelings. You know, can we just, you know, really shape, almost like shaming the kids into adhering to that rule. And then there's a sort of third version, which is much more collegiate and collaborative, which is, you know, you use the caregiver come along and say, look, this is why I don't feel comfortable with you having a games console in your room. Why do you want one? What do you want out of this? Talk it through. Basically do what we should be doing, which is treating teenagers as people with thoughts and opinions that are completely valid, and trying to explain why you think it's not a good idea to have a games console in the bedroom, but trying to acknowledge their side of it and things. And what they found was that you present teenagers with these scenarios, and you ask them things like, how likely are you to stick to this rule? And you ask them, how likely are you to hide your tech use? If, you know, if you were this teenager, how likely would you be to hide your tech use from that parent, right? And what you find is that in the authoritarian scenario, kids say that they you know, they're likely to rebel. And in the guilt tripping scenario, kids say that they're likely to rebel against the rules. And then in the really kind of collegiate, nice, best case scenario, kids say that they're likely to rebel.
Okay.
So you know, they're going to break the rules, and that's quite an important part of being a kid. Yeah. You know, is understanding those boundaries and pushing them, and you know, it's all part of identity formation and things like that. The worrying thing was that it was only in the nice scenario where kids said that they weren't likely to hide their tech use from their parents.
Yeah.
So in the authoritarian ones and stuff, they say they're more likely to do it. And that's the worry, right? You know, when we're hiding our tech use, when kids are hiding their tech use from the people in their own homes, it's not about tracking what they're doing and, you know, helicopter parenting. It's about being there if they need you, if something goes wrong. It's, you know, creating a support network, a buffer, a cushion, so that if something bad does happen, they've got somebody to talk to about it, somebody that they can help deal with it and fix it, so that it doesn't become as big a thing as it might otherwise be if they're dealing with that on their own.
Hmm.
And I think that's that's not a simple thing to get into a slogan like no more than 2 hours a day, right? It requires quite deep conversations about, you know, what are the appropriate... So in the book, I don't talk about rules or limits, but more things like how we establish expectations in the home around what we want out of our screen use and our other things, and just being as open and transparent and talking as much about these things as possible, right? Trying to understand why you want to be on Instagram at 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have these conversations with my wife about this, you know, that we kind of sit there, we're both knackered, we both want to go to bed, really. But then we're sat there for an hour sometimes, not every night, but sometimes we're like sat there on Instagram and we talk about this, you know, why are we doing this? And, you know, sometimes it's things like, you know, we're sort of so tired, we don't want to go through all the rigmarole of getting ready for bed. And it's a silly thing, right? It's a stupid thing to say that because, you know, you're only making it worse for yourself by not going to bed. But, you know, there have been times for me recently where, you know, I've not been very well recently, and that's translated into not getting good sleep. And I've sort of developed bad sleep associations. Like, I feel nervous about going to bed because I'm worried that I'm not going to get any sleep that night. And again, I know it's like a bit of a silly thing, but you know, if you develop those kind of worry thoughts about going to bed, and then you go to bed and you don't sleep, that impacts your want to go to sleep. So it's almost like you're then using that tech use as a distraction, almost. It's not necessarily the tech use itself that's the bad thing. It's not being on Instagram that's the bad thing. It's the context of why.
Yeah.
But the important thing is talking about all of that so you can kind of verbalize and vocalize maybe things that you've not explicitly thought about, but also you're talking about that in a shared environment and trying to understand what the other members of your family and, you know, friends even, what they're getting out of their tech use and how we can navigate that better. Mm. So I think one thing that I think is really important in all of this is that for our generation, Max, we, you know, what happened was that smartphones appeared, and nobody told us how to use them, right? I remember getting my first iPhone and going, this is awesome.
Yeah, they're incredible.
Now what do I do with it? What do I do with it? And you wing it, right? You figure it out. And it's true. I think it's true for most people. Like if you ask people, can you remember when you first joined Instagram or Twitter or whatever social media? Can you remember when you joined it? And can you remember why you joined it? And I think for a lot of people, the answer to that is can't really remember. It's just sort of what everybody else was doing. And I didn't have a reason to join it. I just did. And what happens in those sorts of scenarios is that you try and figure out why you're using it and how you're using it over time. And for some people, it goes really well. And for some people, it goes spectacularly wrong.
Mm.
We didn't have that scaffolding when we were trying to figure this out. And what we need to start doing is providing that scaffolding for kids, right? So that when they do get their smartphones, iPads, or start using social media, they're not like we were in 2007, right? They've got more of a toolkit for dealing with that.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say, well, there's lots of people who are sort of adults and people are kind of maybe not quite as old as me because I'm very old.
Almost
50, yes, 50.
Maybe you'll be 50 by the time this comes out.
I will be 50 by the time it comes
out. Happy birthday. everyone tweet happy birthday at my dad.
Ugh, fine.
Absolutely.
So there are lots of people, perhaps not quite as old as me, but who are producing toolkits for young people for negotiating the internet. What do you think, Tess? Because my feeling is that young people are just sorting it out themselves largely. Ooh. What do you think?
In terms of our own usage?
Yeah, or not even like how much you use, but using the internet safely.
I think that people are figuring it out for themselves. But I think the issue is that we're figuring it out through trial and error, which is not a healthy way to be figuring things out. I mean, I did some of my own, I mean, it's embarrassing, I take drama A level, but I did some of my own research for a drama project we were doing, and we looked at just the people around us, so like just the people who were sat across from us on the bus, like their experience joining the internet, what age they joined, like the worst thing they ever saw, you know, I mean, big jump there, but, and we found that everyone that we spoke to, like we didn't filter this out anyway. It was just everyone we spoke to had had some sort of bad experience on the internet.
Mm.
And whether or not they use it healthily now, which a lot of people still can't. Because, you know, you spend those late hours scrolling through. They've had one of these bad experiences, which has actually affected their mental health.
Mm.
So I think you're right that we do eventually figure out what's good for us. But not only does that take us a while and there's a lot of damage caused on the way, but we can know what's good for us and still not do it.
So that those are really, yeah. really important questions, aren't they?
Yeah. And I think it's really great to hear that. And one of the things that is becoming increasingly apparent to me in this wider public debate about screens is that your voice is missing from this. Teenagers, you know, when you look at research that actually engages teenagers and asks them about this, you get some really interesting nuanced responses. But by and large, you know, it's people our age that are having these big arguments, right? And I think that's a really, it's really important that we do something about that and, you know, engage kids in both in the research processes, but in the kind of discourse processes about, you know, if we're talking about policy and regulation in the end, definitely. But it's also interesting that you say, because you're right, Max, that there are lots of like initiatives out there and toolkits for you know, navigating our online worlds. And it's interesting that the flip side of that is that everybody still feels like they're making their own way through using the internet. Mm. And this is something that I've been worried about a little bit, actually, a lot recently, because the thing that I've been arguing about is, you know, when you look at, you know, the anxious generation and what John Haidt talks about in there, you know, he says, you know, talks about these bans on, you know, no smartphones under for 16.
So this is a recent book by Jonathan Haidt, just so you just to contextualize that.
Yeah. So again, at face value, they seem like almost sensible approaches in that, you know, if you don't have access to social media or smartphones, then almost sort of by definition, they can't harm you. Right.
Yeah.
But my worry is that those sorts of solutions in and of themselves, A, they're not workable because, well, for very practical reasons, you know, like kids can't get, you can't legally get a mobile phone contract if you're younger than 16, right? So it's not the case that kids are going out and buying phones illicitly. It's that they're getting hand-me-downs, and that's much harder to regulate than than buying them. But also, if you just put the ban in and nothing else, all you do is push the problem back a few years.
Yeah.
Because then what happens, you know, let's say that this amazingly perfect ban system happens and we enact it and it works.
So right? Just no clarify, kids... he's suggesting, because I switch off when his name comes up because I'm like, just a whole brain melt nonsense.
You were like, oh, I just don't want to hear what he has to say.
I've read some stuff by him and I'm just like not impressed. Shots fired, as you kids like to say.
Oh, God.
anyway, all right, fine. But he's suggesting a ban for, or a smartphone ban for under 16s?
I think it's, I can never remember which way around it is. It's no smartphones before 14, okay. I think, and then no social media before 16.
Right.
Something along those sorts of lines.
Okay.
And then no phones in schools. And I think the other thing that he suggests is kids need to have more unsupervised play. Totally agree with that.
100%. Yeah, we're all behind that one. Let's just move that on aside. That's the bit of
good friends. Yeah. So... And you know, I'm not in and of itself 100% against bans, but I am against them if they are just enacted in isolation, right? So I'd say I'm not 100% against them, but also I think practically they're not workable because, like we were talking about before, how do you define social media in that case?
Mm.
And I worry about blanket bans on social media because, again, if you engage kids with work and teenagers with research in this area, you find that actually there are a lot of benefits to social media, particularly for marginalized groups.
Yeah,
you know, they're very often the way to create positive social networks, support networks. Mm. The only way that that can happen is online for, you know, LGBTQ plus groups and other sort of marginalized groups in that sort of way. If you just enact these sorts of things without any digital literacy training beforehand, all that happens is that, you know, like I say, you know, even if that ban was perfect, you get to age 16 and then the problems start again because everybody's still trying to wing how to figure out how to use it through trial and error, right? So that 100% what needs to happen first is that we need to build proper digital literacy skills training, and that needs to be, that's the thing that needs to be regulated, right? That's the thing that needs to be rolled out nationally, internationally. And I know that lots of people are trying to do this. There are lots of charities and community interest groups and others that are trying to develop these things, but they're very, and some of them are great, but they're all haphazard and they're only limited in their effectiveness in small groups of people, right? Yeah. What we need is something that's much more national, much more targeted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, a ban is completely bonkers to think that any ban could ever happen. And you're missing out on so much. They are such a gateway to so much wonder. I mean, I suppose you could say, well, it's just they're not targeting screens; they're just targeting phones. But you know, you can't assume that everyone's got access to a big screen like on the wall. You know, a lot of you think about the families that I work with. You know, they might have a telly, but then someone else will be watching it. If you want to have your own media consumption or your own kind of connection to the outer world, it might be the only thing that you have, access.
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned the connection to like LGBTQ communities, but like specifically, because if you're somebody who's in a family where you might not be accepted, you really end up relying on those online communities.
Completely.
And I hadn't thought about that in this debate, but that's
I think it's a really important example. I suppose one of the things just to reflect on, and we've been talking for a very long time now. And
this is really interesting.
Oh, great. Okay. I mean, I love it. one of the things I'm reflecting on is the thing we keep coming back to is what bad means is defined by the individual. So you talked about it, Tess, when you talked to your friends and they said they had some bad experiences which were bad for them. They didn't like it. And you talked about it as well, Pete, when you know you're not having a good time on Instagram. And that's actually, I think that's actually quite a healthy way of thinking of it. If you're not having a good time, if you are upset or, you know, hurt, reflect on whether your own behavior has I mean, if I have a history of you know, kind of getting into arguments with people and getting upset about that on Twitter previously. But before I more or less left Twitter. And that is something that I can reflect on my own behavior and my own predilection for making speaking arguments. The thing about the moralistic bent of people like Haight and I can never pronounce his name. And the kind of the kind of 2 hours a day brigade is that they are saying you're harming yourself without knowing. You might think you're having a nice time, but you're not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I think when people fall into these doom scrolls, we call them, they know.
Yeah. They know what's happening. What I think.
That's one of the biggest things is that you know that what you're doing is harming you.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. But you just, it's so easy to just keep going. That's the thing. That's what we keep circling back to, really.
Yeah, and yeah, there's a lot of chat about this. So I think it was The Social Dilemma, that documentary a few years ago. You know, they talked to people who were in the industry, and you know, this idea of, I don't know if it was in that actually, but you know, this idea of the infinite scroll. You know, this idea that you don't get to the bottom of a page on Twitter and then have to click go to next page to get the next set of tweets. It's just it constantly refreshes and adds bits to the bottom. That I think there's some sort of apocryphal story somewhere that the person who invented that like really regrets it, because you know it's like this super addictive thing. And again, it's not addiction, because I don't think addiction is the right framework to think about these sorts of things.
Okay.
That wasn't created in order to addict people to a social media feed. It was created because it's a user-friendly thing to do, right? It improves the user experience. And I think that's the problem that we have when we talk about addictive by design quite a lot, that actually what we're talking about is features of our phones, features of social media that are just easy and convenient to use, and we find them compelling. But because of that, we can develop these bad habits, right? That we can do these things. And like you say, like we know when we're doom scrolling, and it's not because that's what the thing has been designed to do. It's because we've had a bad day, or we're not in a good frame of mind, and maybe we're not reflecting our behavior that much, or we don't have the sort of self-control pool and like enough of it left to stop doing that sort of thing, right? Yeah. And the thing about those two different ways of thinking is that it's not the case that in one scenario we're talking about something bad happening and the other one we're saying that nothing, you know, there's nothing to see here, it's fine. It's not the case at all. Bad things happen in both scenarios. It's just in one scenario, the only solution that you're left with is to stop using it altogether.
Yeah.
And in the other scenario, the solution is harder, but it leaves you with good, potentially, if you get it right, it leaves you with all the good things that you get out of social media or your smartphone generally. And over time, what you're trying to do is weed out those bad habits.
This links in quite well the fifth question, but then we've skipped the fourth question.
Don't worry, I think we've more or less answered the fourth question.
You'll never know what the fourth question is.
Which you'll never know what it is.
Okay.
It's a mystery.
So, question number five. What should people who are worried about screen time do?
I think one of the big things is to not panic. I think it's very clear that we really worry about this. I think often in quite a visceral sense, if you look at some of the conversations that we have about these things, ironically online, people are having very deep emotional reactions, emotional worries to screen use. And, you know, from talking to parents as well, the undertone that I see quite a lot is almost like a sense of despair that, you know, it's too late now. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think it does require effort. And that's the hard sell part of this, that you do have control over this. You know, you do have a say. This is not something that has happened to you by design from a big evil tech company. That's not to say that the big tech companies are completely angelistic. You know, there are some real problems there that we need to, you know, and we absolutely need to hold them to task on some things. Yeah. But I think it's very easy for the tech industry to ignore the real problems at the minute, because it's quite easy to dismiss these broad level screen time is bad nonsense conversations, right? So it, in a weird way, in terms of having these very big panics, we're not being very effective in holding them to account in the ways that we need to, right? But part of that starts with, you know, reflecting on your own tech use. Stop worrying about screen time. It's not a thing. It's not something to worry about. Think about it in terms of what you and your family are getting out of your digital technology use. Where there are good things, don't feel guilty about them, because they're good things. Where there are bad things, again, don't feel guilty about that. Don't feel as though that somehow a failure on your part, that you've developed a bad habit or that you're struggling with this thing. But just talk about it, reflect on it, try different things. So, you know, I've got an entire chapter in the book on sleep, and the big thing that I wanted to focus on there was this whole idea of blue light from screens, and does it interrupt melatonin in the brain and, you know, disrupt sleep effectively. And I'm not going to get into the mess of the research that's in that area, but one thing is that, you know, on an iPhone, there's something called night shift mode, right? Which is at a certain time of the evening, it will turn your screen really yellow. And the theory there is that by turning the screen more yellow, there's less blue light, so it's better for you, right? And there's some research that shows that it doesn't work.
Slightly inconveniently.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I say towards the end of the book is turn night shift mode on your phone, not because it's going to have a biological effect, but, you know, I've got it on my phone. And the thing that it does for me is that I really notice when my screen goes yellow and it's like an indicator for me. That it's sort of saying to me, oh, okay, actually, I need to start getting ready for bed now. So it's almost like a weird visual alarm.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point.
So, you know, try things out. You know, there's one of the things that people talk about, which is like turn your screen grayscale to make it less interesting.
I hated it, and I just turned it
back. Yeah, I think it's just a silly idea personally, but, you know, try it. And if it works for you, if it helps you change a bad habit, more power to you. Great. Yeah. I'm really glad that it's helped.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's different things work for different people. Because for me, I tried that, and then all of the videos that I was watching were like art videos and people like doing hair, putting wigs on. And I was like, well, I can't.
Well, that's not going to help.
Yeah, like outfit reveals. I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? But what I've got, which does work for me, I have an app. I have an app, and when I try, and you can like set. So this is, again, linking to the thing of different things are harmful for different people.
Okay.
On my little app that I have.
Yeah.
That you can make like a list of certain apps and be like, 10-second delay off, like just before I open this app, where it asks you, is this important?
Oh.
And then after 5 minutes of using that app, after you've unlocked it, it gives you a reminder. It's like, hey, you're still using this. It's been 5 minutes. Is it still important?
Yeah,
and it doesn't do that for every app.
Yeah.
You can pick which ones you want it to do it for.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't restrict your use completely.
No.
But it does give you that reminder.
Do you remember the Wii used to do that when we would play Wii Sports Resort constant for hours and hours, and every so often it would say, are you sure you should still be playing this? I need to win at dog frisbee.
Yeah. And I mean, that does bring up another question of, do the like the companies themselves have to take some responsibility for this?
Well, let's, Pete, what do you, I think we have to talk about that.
I think so, definitely. Yeah, I think absolutely, you know, that, what we're fundamentally talking about here is technologies of pleasure, technologies of entertainment, of convenience. And I've said this a lot recently, but so I apologize if people have heard this before, but if that's the case, if that's what we're doing, 100% well-being needs to be at the core of design, right?
Mm.
You need to be thinking about how do we make this work for people and have a positive outcome on them, right? And I think it's very clear that in some cases that's not happening.
Yeah.
You know, things have gone off the rails. There are other pressures, other industry pressures that are taking precedent, right? And that the outcome there is perhaps that well-being isn't at the forefront, and it's people's well-being that's taking an impact as a result. So I think, you know, there does need to be a huge amount of reflection and sort of critical, you know, self-reflection, thinking about what's going on for companies. I think if we can move beyond this very broad level, ultimately what I think is incorrect way of thinking of saying, you know, social media is driving mental illness, therefore we need to do something about social media, but get into the specifics of, look, you do the research in the right sort of way, in this sort of nuanced, considered way, and you find that it's this particular set of mechanisms on a particular social media app that actually, you know, if you take those out, people have a much better experience.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we've not got those studies yet. We've not got to that level of study. Or that, you know, we find that these sorts of communication channels, these routes, you know, through, you know, it turns out that text-based messaging systems where the texts disappear after 10 seconds, actually that's really bad for this particular group of people or this particular type of mental health issue or something like that. Whereas these ones are better for other people, like trying to get to that level. That what that allows you to do is hold the industry to task a lot more.
Mm.
And I appreciate the counterpoint to that is people come along and say, that's wonderful, Pete. That's very much a scientist who is completely detached from the reality of the situation, saying, well, in 10, 15, 20 years' time, when we have this better science, then we can hold industry to task. I'm not saying that at all. You know, we need to be evidence-based about a lot of these things. And I fully appreciate people are worried about tech use now. But even in the now, when we've not got that full evidence base yet, I think we can be smarter and more specific about what it is that we're worried about,
yeah,
and what we want them to do and what we want to hold them to task about, rather than social media bad.
Yeah. Clearly, I mean, absolutely, that's right. And I think, you know, there's the sort of the argument against that as the kind of precautionary principle of, you know, well, it might be bad, so we should ban it. That is, because people often wheel that out as if it's some kind of trump card. And I'm like,
you could say that about anything.
Literally everything, like bicycles. You know, yeah, bicycles could, yeah, on that basis be banned, and you're not taking my, yeah, bike away.
And I think what's missed in that conversation very often is the opportunity cost, right? So because we have this feeling that social media is unequivocally bad, that what, you know, if that turns out to be not the case with research later on, well, what's the harm now? If we stop it now, then we might stop some really bad things happening. And if we were wrong about it, well, things aren't worse. But actually, we don't know that that's the case, right? So we don't know that there might potentially be some protective effects of social media in certain cases, or that things might be much worse if they weren't if those sorts of support networks weren't around. Actually, the honest answer there, the objective answer, is we don't know that. We do know that there are some positive effects of social media as well as negative. We know that for some communities, they're really important sources of support. And we also know that when bans on digital tech have happened, they don't work.
They don't work. Yeah. Neither do,
so we know,
time limits. Put that back.
Yeah.
In.
Yeah. So, you know, we know that there's often unintended backfire effects. Mm. You know, this happened in South Korea 10 years ago. They were worried about kids not sleeping and their educational attainment as a result, so they put in a curfew, so teenagers weren't allowed on the internet between midnight and 6 a.m. Tick, you know, job done. They literally can't go on the internet during that time, so they're not going on the internet.
Yeah,
so
definitely not.
Fixes the problem. And what you find happens, so about 7 or 8 years later, some researchers come along and look at the effect of this, and they find that the net impact on teenage sleep is that it improves teenage sleep, but it only improves teenage sleep by a minute and a half per night. So actually, they're not getting more sleep. And actually, over the course of the day, they're spending more time on the internet than they were before. It's just shifted to earlier in the day. Mm. And, you know, arguably in the week, that's going to be a problem because it will interfere more with the school day. So I would, you know, tentatively suggest, my opinion is that law didn't work.
These are the same tentative about it. You can't be more than tentative about it. Who can?
Gently suggest that maybe that didn't have the effect that was intended.
Yes, I mean, I remember the articles trumpeting this as a great leap forward, which went very quiet when the actual data came in.
Yeah, and you see similar things with, you know, bans on loot boxes in video games. So there are a few countries that have banned these sort of specific ways of spending money on games that a lot of people are worried are very problematic. Mm. And what's happened in those countries is, in some cases, I don't know whether it's the games companies have just ignored the ban and carried on selling them anyway, or it's not been clear how to enact it, so they've carried on selling them anyway. But the net effect is that there's been no effect of the ban. Or it's not been worth modifying the game to remove that element of it, so they just stop selling that game in that particular country.
Mm.
And nobody can play that game in that particular country. And that seems like a shame.
Yeah, and a lot of these things are quite integral to all the systems of the game. Yeah. Just stripping them out. I mean, we can talk about loot boxes is probably something for another day, but it's not
of
straightforward.
About that I don't think are very relevant.
Okay, I mean, I think we've sort of covered an awful lot of ground.
Yeah.
Huge amounts, and I think what I really like about the kind of central message here, and it's first of all, I like the fact that there isn't a simplistic kind of 5-point plan here. And it, again, like we've said before, people like an authority to come and tell them what to do about this complex stuff, and you don't do that.
Life is hard. Who needs more questions?
Well, we do. Everyone does.
That's the whole.
But I think the other thing to marry that, and I think this is really comes through with the book, which I really do commend to people, because it is an optimistic book. It isn't a kind of Pollyanna-ish, everything's fine book, but it isn't ultimately a very personal book, by the way. We haven't really talked about that very much, but a very personal book from you, but also ultimately an optimistic book about our relationship and how we can make it better. So I think that's something to take away. If you don't get 5 points from this episode, you get that feeling we can change this.
We could probably come up with 5 points.
Okay,
one,
fine.
Don't panic. Two, there's no simple answers to questions. And I've run out.
Three to five, see above.
Yeah.
Habits, not addictions, I think is a good one. So try not to think about this in terms of addiction. Mm-hmm. Think about it in terms of habit formation. Habits are something that you can do about.
Yeah.
Do something
okay,
about.
Okay, maybe you have got a 5-point plan. That's good.
Different things for different people.
Okay, well, there you are. Well done, guys.
Parenting is hard.
Tell me about it. is there anything else you wanted to kind of convey to our, you know, vast audience of the ADHD Science Podcast?
I don't think so, really. I'm really glad that you found it optimistic. I think I worry sometimes I may be naively optimistic about this sort of stuff, but I think
you have that worry. That's a good indication.
Yeah, well, maybe. Thank you for saying that.
No worries. That's what I do.
I think it is. The point of the book is to try and be reassuring without being overly simplistic and without, you know, saying that there's nothing to worry about. And I think that's the key thing, that if in a lot, you know, these conversations that we've had, these very public conversations we've had recently, if you found yourself getting really worried about those, then hopefully if you read my book, it will center those worries a little bit more. That, you know, it'll give you maybe a direction to think about in terms of, well, what things are you specifically worried about in terms of your own digital tech use, and what things can you do about that? And I think that's hopefully, well, I mean, obviously I'm biased because I wrote the book, but to me, that feels like a good starting point for making bigger changes across the board.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll stop it there. Thank you so much, Pete, for joining us. You're actually the first person I've had on two different podcasts as a guest. Because back in the day, you were on my play-based one. But yes, it was a great pleasure to speak to you again. And thank you very much, and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Right.
Hello.
That was Pete.
That was
so,
Pete.
Tess, good luck with your exams.
Thank you. Good luck with your exams if you're listening to this for some reason and you have exams coming up.
Yes, exam season is upon us.
This is an educational podcast.
It is. Well, we aim for it to be so.
Yeah.
Anyway, we will see you probably in the autumn. We'll do some recording over the summer and then come back with some episodes in the autumn. Have a good summer, everybody, and
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.